My name is Kelly Malcolm, registration number 34108. I represent appellant father J.W.M. I'm going to be yielding the balance of my time after making my argument regarding reasonable efforts to the other appellant, who is appellant mother. I am aware that the court has read the briefs as well as the record, and not to be redundant, but reasonable efforts is indicated in CRS 19-3-208, paragraph 89, and it basically means the exercise of diligence and care. I'm also aware that to even raise this issue with the Court of Appeals and to preserve it for appellate review, that there is a difference in divisions, that one division has held that if the parent hasn't objected to the department's efforts before a termination hearing, the parents waive their right to challenge the efforts. And that case was not cited in my brief or anyone else's at this point in time that I'm aware of. But I also know, on the other hand, another division in this court has held that a parent's failure to raise perceived errors with the department's efforts does not bar a review of the evidence supporting the trial court's reasonable efforts finding. So based upon the division in the court, I would like to proceed with just presenting some evidence and some legal arguments as to why I believe reasonable efforts was not met in this particular case.
But that issue was not raised by your client below?
This issue was not, Your Honor. I'm just noting it for the record because with my research, I was aware that there was a difference of opinion in the court, so I just wanted to raise it. With the reasonable effort standards, in order to basically accomplish and to satisfy the standards that are in the statute, the Colorado courts have actually made it a little bit easier in the sense that they have defined what reasonable efforts are, and that's in CRS section 19-2-208. And in there are services that need to be provided. One under section B talks about what shall be provided, and that's absent funding. In particular, there is paragraph I, which is screening and assessments. This includes home visits, and the record is very clear that the department did not do a home visit from August of 2013 until the termination hearing with my client. The other area that was a shall prevail was visitations. That's a service that should be provided. The department unilaterally canceled those visits in February of 2014, and the other appellant will actually go into more detail as to the due process provisions that were not followed underneath the cancellation of the visits. In addition, Your Honors, under Section D, it talks about services that should be provided should funding remain available. The record does not, it is totally mute on the point of whether the department had funding or not. My read of the statute is, if that is a bar for the department to provide services, they should have noted it on the record. One of those services that was not provided was transportation. And if a review of the trial record of the termination hearing indicated that transportation was an issue at the beginning of this case, transportation services were not provided, nor is there an explanation, and that would have been funding. The other and the most key part of the whole argument was drug and alcohol treatment. The department did not provide any drug treatment for my client. Nicotine is a drug, and it's well known it's a drug. And there is many, many studies that have indicated that nicotine is as addictive as heroin, cocaine, or alcohol, and that is found under the U.S. Center for Disease Control, which was last updated in February of 2014.
What about father's testimony that he quit smoking on his own?
Father did quit for a period of time, and that is consistent, Your Honor, with people who are basically going through drug and alcohol treatment. They do well for a while, but then they fall off and we have relapse. Without having services in place, supportive services, to be able to deal with addiction issues, it actually hampers anyone's ability to be free of drugs, alcohol, including nicotine. I think the other issue, and more paramount, at least in my mind's eye from a legal standpoint, would be the purpose that the department was created and existed, is to deal with parents who are dysfunctional or what would be called more irresponsible. You are not dealing with a population that can take a piece of paper, process it, and run with it for various reasons. By the department not providing the nicotine treatment services, as well as the others that were mentioned, what they've done is, in a sense, shifted the burden from themselves to be able to ameliorate and improve and perform what was underneath the treatment plan, and shifted that burden to parents who, by nature and of the creation of the Department of Social Services, are not equipped to handle it. And I think in that sense, it's unfair to be able to shift the burden from the party who is responsible in trying to improve and have the parents be able to reunify, which is one of the requirements underneath CRS, I believe it's 19-3208. One of the services is to be able to reunify families, to provide a treatment plan that's going to work. And by shifting that burden to a parent to say, you figure out a way to quit smoking and get back to me when you've got it completed, it is abdicating the responsibility. So I'm going to leave the balance and the rest of my time to my colleague. Thank you.
Just before you depart, there was no request by father for any kind of treatment to deal with his tobacco use.
That is correct, Your Honor. No specific request on the record that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, there never is a request when people have addiction issues. You don't have them coming up and asking, gee, I have an issue with pot. You know, can I get some help? It's the first step is denial.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Cindy Fletcher, and I represent the other appellant on this case, the mother, K.M. Your Honor, mother also made a argument in this case about reasonable efforts, but we would defer to the argument that was just presented by father's counsel, rely on the law that she was already cited, so it's not be redundant, unless this court has specific issues about mother's specific arguments on reasonable efforts, which certainly I'd be happy to entertain. Rather, I would like to use my portion of the time to address our argument of due process violation. Your Honor, Colorado, before the United States Supreme Court got involved in deciding anything about due process and child welfare, issued a ruling in the AMD case stating that there is a fundamental right to a parent to be able to parent their children. That was later confirmed on a national level through the Troxell case through the United States Supreme Court, and then later applied specifically amongst all the courts, saying that parents have the right in any dependency and neglect case or child welfare matter to due process to be applied consistently throughout the entire case. The case that applied it specifically to that extent was the Stantosky versus Kramer case. The concern that mother has in this case is that she has a fundamental right to parent these children. That's not to say that the department can't get involved in the safety of children and take temporary custody. We're not arguing that that was improperly done here. But in the context of a dependency neglect case, when Human Services has custody of the children, the only opportunity a parent has to that fundamental right takes place during their court-ordered visitation. And that is the concern we have here, is that she was denied her constitutional right to parent her children in a visitation setting. The concern that we primarily have is that there seems to be a big gap that occurred in this case. We have the right to due process throughout this case, means certain procedures have to be followed before you can strip the parent of their fundamental rights. And our argument is that those weren't followed. I'm not sure I can tell the court today exactly what procedure it is that should have been followed, and that's part of what I'm asking the court to decide on mother's behalf and behalf of all parents who are involved in these cases. When we have a parent who is working in the context of a dependency and neglect case, it's very different than any other legal case. In no criminal case would we send our client to go speak to an investigator without their attorney present. In no car injury case would we send our client to go talk to the other side's insurance company without having attorneys present. But in the context of DNNs, which we all pride ourselves on being collaborative, we regularly send our clients, who are often very simple, not quite educated folks, in to talk with the other side, with social workers with advanced degrees, and investigators present, without their attorneys there, in the interest of saying, you have to have a relationship with the department and be able to form that so that you can bridge your family getting back somewhere. I'm not trying to say that the attorneys need to complicate that or that we need to be there every single time there's a communication between the department and the parents. That would make the whole system incredibly clogged up. But what we have here is a simple parent, and there was a witness at the trial who testified that her way of going about the world and interacting with the world was very simple and very, very childlike.
I'm sorry, but I've lost the focus of your argument here. I mean, where is the due process issue in terms of the department talking to people who are represented by counsel?
The problem that I have, Your Honor, and that Mother has, is that it was communicated from the department directly to a parent who was rather simple that we're going to have to stop your visits, what was supposed to be temporarily, and this is why. But there was no attempt from the department to communicate directly to Mother's attorney on a very serious issue, and this parent, who is very simple, doesn't quite know how to advocate for themselves and is represented by counsel, is then presumed that they're going to go out and the burden is then on them to tell their attorney, this is what happened, I don't understand what is going on, is there something that we need to do?
Isn't there evidence in the record that your client had just such a communication with her attorney?
Your Honor, I was not notified by my client until February that she had her visits canceled.
And when were they canceled or suspended?
They were suspended in November, and I believe the record reflects that both Father's trial counsel and myself filed motions very quickly after finding out that the visits had been canceled. Father was the first one who went to the court and got it filed, and so we simply filed ours as a joinder of Father's motion.
So are you suggesting that we engraft onto this process, in the interest of due process, some kind of a requirement as to when social services has to communicate with counsel rather than communicate directly with a parent?
I am, Your Honor. And I think when we're talking about something as serious as canceling a parent's visits, which is taking away, stripping them of one of their fundamental rights, this is not a very difficult burden. It's as simple as drafting some sort of a formal notice to the parent, to the counsel, saying, we are asking to suspend visits, this is why we are asking that, and then giving counsel an opportunity, a guaranteed opportunity, to be heard by the court with an evidentiary hearing as to why are we stripping the parent of this due process right.
But isn't it the parent's choice about whether they want to talk with anyone about this, whether it's their counsel or their neighbor or their sister? Why should the department override the parent's choice about who they want to speak to about these issues?
Well, yeah, and I certainly agree, and I think I could probably speak for all respondent parent counsel who practice in this area, that can be a big frustration sometimes of dealing with the parties that we represent. Again, these are simple folk who don't have experience coming into the system and navigating these kinds of complications. They're often in the system for a reason, and they don't necessarily understand the importance of doing that. They don't communicate well. That's why they are where they are to begin with. I think this is just adding one more layer of protection to ensure that something like this doesn't fall through the cracks.
Can you help us with any authority in Colorado or elsewhere that has recognized a due process implication in the types of communications or lack of communication?
You know, the primary authority that I would turn to, again, is the Stantosky case, which is a federal case in which it says that the parent-child relationship triggers constitutional due process concerns and triggers fundamental due process concerns throughout the entirety of a dependency and neglect case.
Well, I don't think that's in dispute, but can you point to anything, any more specific authority that imposes some kind of a due process limitation on a department's communicating directly with a respondent parent.
Your Honor, I would also submit that perhaps that the ALL versus People in the Interest of CZ case, which is a Colorado case from 2010, would apply, in which it points out that parents have a statutory right to be represented by counsel at every stage of a child welfare case, and when we've got a serious issue of this magnitude and the department fails to communicate directly with counsel, that they are effectively being stripped of their right to counsel in that specific context.
Okay, well, that wasn't the issue in ALL, correct?
Well, that was part of the legal ruling that came from ALL. I mean, this case could be distinguished tremendously naturally from that case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. John Thurkell, attorney registration number 13865, Assistant Douglas County Attorney, appearing on behalf of the Appley Department. The Appley respectfully presents the following oral argument for the court's consideration. This is a particularly compelling case in terms of the assessment and the discretion that a trial court has about what is present in 19.3604 subparagraph 3, giving primary consideration to the physical, mental, and emotional needs of a child. And we note that WMN was a premature child, and particularly from the testimony of the foster adopt parent at trial, as well as Appley Department's Exhibit 2, it is quite clear that this child was medically fragile and medically compromised. Being born approximately 2 months premature, which the parents were very aware of the premature status and certain risks that flowed with that, including the possibility of a severe infantile asthma condition. Now, they were aware of the condition. What they weren't aware of and demonstrated really no substantial ability was the ability to then appropriately care for the child. This child was hospitalized for just shy of the first 2 months of his life as a result of a number of different conditions, including the need for further pulmonary development. And even with the benefit of that hospitalization, continues to suffer from a number of different serious diagnoses, probably the most life-threatening of which is the severe asthma. The testimony by the foster adopt parent and the recommendations of the pediatric pulmonologist paint a picture of a severely fragile child who is very much at risk. At risk should there be any smoke, which in the eyes of the pediatric pulmonologist included what she referred to as even second or third degree types of smoke exposure. And there was a clear recommendation by that doctor that the child have a smoke-free environment. We know from the testimony of the parents that they acknowledge being told about those concerns by the Appley Department's caseworker. The mother acknowledged in her testimony while the child was still hospitalized after birth about being told of those considerations and the need for a smoke-free environment.
What about the argument that the department engaged in no efforts whatsoever to help the parents with smoking?
Your Honor, I think that there was good information flow both from the medical staff involved in treatment of the child as well as the caseworker, and the parents were aware of that. There are, though, limits to reasonable efforts. I would note in the record that through probation, the father was involved in substance abuse treatment. He didn't comply with it, the record would indicate, due to difficulties in keeping appointments, and he didn't comply with the monitoring of that, but he would have had an avenue, should he chosen that, to seek treatment specifically for nicotine or cigarette addiction. And Your Honor, I would submit that many of those...
Excuse me, are you saying that because he was already in some kind of a drug treatment program, he could have asked to expand that to address his use of nicotine?
That's exactly the point, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record that supports that?
There is in the testimony of the father acknowledging that he had probation requirements that addressed both the domestic violence and substance abuse considerations. That was also contained in the testimony of the department's caseworker, that he wasn't separately being required, other than the probation requirements, to address the substance abuse, but he was not successful in that treatment program due to not keeping the requirements of that. And further, Your Honor, I would submit that there is a limit to reasonable efforts there. Most substance abuse treatment programs are not specific to cigarettes or nicotine products, but other types of substance abuse, and many of the efforts that an individual could use, frankly, are over-the-counter or practical measures available to them that don't involve prescriptions or that level of treatment. And if we look at the record here, these parents have such an unstable, chaotic lifestyle. There are certain limits about their effort availability here. The appellee department's Exhibit 4, which the mother in her testimony identified that particular exhibit and indicated that it represented a condition in her home, in October through December of 2013. And that picture even shows the diaper bag that was used for the care of this child and contained the child's diapers, as well as then an ottoman that in Exhibit 6 had both a full ashtray, and mother in her testimony indicated that may not have all been her contribution, but that she did smoke and place the remains of her cigarettes in that. Also contained a hookah. There was testimony by the parents that they didn't take even simple and obvious practical steps. The mother lived with a boyfriend, fiancé, who smoked, as well as her for the majority of the case. Both parents did testify for a narrow window of time, far short of the entire proceeding, that they made an effort and they did stopped smoking for approximately a month to 2 months, each of them. The mother indicated that the general anxiety caused her to go back to smoking. That would tie to her lack of compliance with the referral that the department made, perhaps to deal with anxiety through individual therapy. The father, in his testimony, identified that he lived with a best friend and a best friend's fiance, both of whom, in addition to himself, were smokers. These were practical steps they could have taken to identify that. The father frequently used his mother's car for transportation, including the visits with the child, and he was aware in his testimony that his mother was a smoker, and he acknowledged that the car had the odor of smoke as a result of that. The parents did have transportation available to them, not full-time, but there was testimony in the record that the mother had a car available to her during the period that the child was hospitalized, and the father would accept rides with her. There was testimony of at least one occasion that the foster adopt parents provided transportation to the father from a visit at the hospital with his son, and the father had a car available through the mother. But they didn't take or identify even practical steps, simple things that would have given them any opportunity to then have contact with the child and not expose the child to smoke. This then is about the lack of substantial compliance with the treatment plan and a treatment plan that addresses the fitness or unfitness of the parents. We know that the father attended only one of two of 12 parent education sessions with Keith Kravick. There was a difference in the father's testimony from Keith Kravick's testimony in terms of follow-up contact by the father to schedule new visits to complete that process. Mr. Kravick denied any type of message or attempted communication to complete his parent education program. And that's a matter within the sound discretion of the trial court in terms of the credibility of solving those kinds of differences. We also know on the appellant father's side of this that he failed with the substance abuse treatment and monitoring that was adopted into the treatment plan through what he was required to do in probation. We also know that the mother, in addition to not addressing smoke as a threat to the child during the visits, of unilaterally on her own deciding that she wasn't going to pursue or that she didn't need individual treatment. And there was testimony by the caseworker and others that it was never communicated to the mother that she didn't have to follow through on that requirement. The heart of this issue then goes to reasonable efforts, and I guess about transportation, although we would note that there was never a motion filed at any time during this case challenging the requirement about set by the court, both in terms of the emergency protection order at the beginning of the case, and that would have occurred on January 14, 2013. That was reiterated in the court-ordered treatment plan and dispositional orders on April 22, 2013, that there be no odor of smoke that the child was exposed to during parenting time or visitation between the parents and the child. There was never a motion or an argument objecting to the proposed treatment plan initially. There was never a motion to amend the treatment plan, and we believe under the state of Colorado law that many of those considerations as a result have been waived and not preserved for appeal. We do distinguish, and going right to the heart of the matter, happily, department is aware of certain appellate case law applicable in the state of Colorado, including people in the interest of DG, that's found at 140p3rd, page 299, Colorado Appellate Division 3, 2006. And we note that the court is not allowed in Colorado to delegate to a guardian ad litem in a department discretion if it involves a termination or reduction or a negative change in the parent visitation here. But we would distinguish what was involved in this particular case is that there were life-threatening considerations to a medically fragile child if the court didn't set and enforce these orders. This was not a delegation of the court, but actually a determination by the court, again in the form from the very first hearing in the emergency protection order, as well as reaffirmation of that in the treatment plan orders. There, in essence, was a condition preceding to the parents being able to visit their medically fragile son that he not be exposed to smoke because of the possible consequences to his health. So the department here was not exercising discretion. It was actually enforcing the court's order when the parents were unable to live up to that.
And that's the emergency protection order?
It was, Your Honor, and actually the emergency protection order was not only applicable to the parents, but any family members when visiting a child, and at the time that would apply to visiting the child in the hospital. And again, we believe that there was a reaffirmation of that in the treatment plan orders. At trial, I think the record shows that the trial court judge also responded to the arguments about the lack of parenting time, but the parents never stopped smoking. We would note also that the caseworker testified that She had clearly communicated to the parents that there would be a resumption of visitation if they came up with a practical plan of how they could visit the child but not expose him to smoke. And again, that would come to simple practical steps that a parent would need to be able to make if they were capable of being a safe caretaker for a child, of knowing that you can't smoke yourself.
Mr. Thurkill, sorry to interrupt you. Sure. I want to make sure I get this question out. Earlier you made some comment about the appellant having waived some claims because they were not raised below. Did you make that waiver argument in your response to the petition on appeal?
I don't believe it was contained in that, Your Honor, but I think the case law in this state is quite clear that it is waived on appeal, if not raised at trial below, in terms of objections to what the treatment plan and disposition orders of the court are.
You think it's clear? You don't think there's a disagreement among divisions of this court on the question, as your opponent described?
I think that there is some dispute between the divisions of the court, Your Honor, but there's several cases in terms of the one theory about waiver of that issue.
Okay, thank you.
And my time has ended unless there are questions.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.